You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn. Our focus today is North Carolina House District 20, which includes Wrightsville Beach, Landfall, Porter's Neck, Figure Eight Island, and the Holly Tree, Masonboro Loop, and Monkey Junction areas. Adam Erickson is challenging four-term incumbent Representative Ted Davis, who until this election, with its new legislative maps, represented District 19. Adam Erickson teaches and coaches lacrosse at New Hanover High School. He also volunteers for Meals on Wheels through St. Mark's Catholic Church. And he joins me now. Adam Erickson, welcome to Coastline.
Oh, thank you, Rachel. Thanks for having me.
So never having run for office before, why choose a state race for your first crack at this?
Well, honestly, this year, the stakes are so huge in our history that it really didn't feel like I needed a stepping stone to get to a place. This is a historic moment in our history. There's so many things on the table. There's so much at stake that I just decided that I couldn't wait anymore and I needed to take action right now. I'm not looking for a long-term political career. I'm looking to jump into this race, make a difference in my community, and continue serving as I've been doing in various ways.
Now, of course, you list the major issues on your website, like healthcare and environment and education, but your personal message seems to hold up one galvanizing issue, public education, as the reason you jumped in the race. You say you want to go to Raleigh to fix what is not a level playing field. What would fixing the system require?
Well, as you know, education is not just a simple issue. Our public education system provides so many services to our kids and families that there's no one easy fix. There's a whole comprehensive package that needs to be looked at and worked on. I feel like, initially I got into teaching as a form of service, and I went back and got a master's degree in teaching so I could serve the high school community here. And as I was working in this system, I realized that, you know, while I could affect change with the kids in the classroom and do my best to create relationships and help them, the entire system really needs help, you know, and I thought I would jump into this and really find ways to improve the system for our kids and teachers. Many of our teachers are really suffering with low morale. They don't feel like their profession has been valued. They've been treated as professionals. And, you know, I want to make sure that they get the resources and pay that they need and that we need to attract the best people for this job. And I also found that we're woefully short in sourcing our schools. Many of our kids are still functioning in classrooms that could be decades old. And, you know, it's not just about money. It's how we prioritize what we have. How we create budgets that we reflect our values. So we're going to need a lot of things in our schools. We're going to need long-term solutions. We're going to need a comprehensive package that improves our facilities, which are about $8 billion behind where they should be. Our teacher pay, which still lags behind pre-recession levels. Our per-pupil funding, which is in the middle or near the bottom related to the rest of the country. So we have a lot of work to do, but I'm willing to step up and get in there in the trenches and figure out how we can use our resources to maximize where we should be going as a state and community in the 21st century.
Your opponent, longtime incumbent, 4.5 terms, has worked his way into a position of power, including being a member of the all-powerful Rules Committee, where bills go to live or die. What could you offer as a freshman? And how would you explain that it's not a disservice to the district to lose this kind of influence in the General Assembly?
Well, one of the things that my opponent is running on, Ted Davis, is that his experience is what is needed now to see us through these challenges. However, his experience has not solved any of the challenges that we're facing right now, to be quite frank. And, you know, while he is a powerful member of the House at the moment, you know, when we win the majority back, we have a whole host of fantastically talented, intelligent representatives who are more than capable of filling the job. And, you know, as a freshman, I have, you know, relationships with some existing representatives, of course, people that I know around here and have met. It's a tall order to take on political power, but it is really part of the democratic process. And I'm willing to do that as a member of this community. You know, I don't come to this with a political background. I don't come to this race with owing anybody else anything. You know, I'm just interested in working for the people of this community. Many issues have been left unfinished. You know, we lost the film industry for the most part during the last 10 years. We've discovered a seriously contaminated community with our water issues during the last few years. We've seen our education, public education system be undermined during the last 10 years. So I don't think that experience has gotten us anywhere. In addition, wages have been stagnant. You know, our working class people continue to suffer. Hundreds of thousands of people don't have health care. All of these things, challenges, have not been dealt with during this past 10 years, which shows me that experience is lacking.
Well, let's talk about water quality for a minute, because some people might argue that's one of the biggest issues facing District 20. The fact is, it's been 3 years since we discovered that there were potentially toxic, unregulated compounds in the drinking water supply that couldn't be removed through traditional methods. Perhaps the chemical load has lessened, but it's still there. What needs to happen, in your opinion, to solve this problem?
Well, we certainly need to work with science. You know, this is still an ongoing issue in determining what the situation actually exists now. I mean, we really don't know all of the compounds that are in the water. We're discovering new things all the time. The fact is that during the past 7 years, we have cut funding to the DEQ. We've cut 40% of the positions at the DEQ. Now, maybe those things aren't exactly related to the issue, but I can't help but think that when we cut monitoring and staffing, that we're going to have a problem discovering and fixing the problems that we see.
But isn't part of the issue with the DEQ the fact that they have no regulatory teeth, because these are compounds that they don't regulate, and the EPA doesn't even regulate? There are just health advisories. I mean, what do you do there?
That's exactly right. Well, there needs to be a process that starts developing this regulatory oversight, because that's true. I mean, we have all of these compounds which have been and may still be dumped into our drinking water, which is not replaceable. And there's no regulation on them, which is astounding to me. That and to everybody who lives here, no matter what your political persuasion, to think that there are unregulated compounds dumped in our drinking water that never go away, and we don't have any way to determine whether they're safe or not, at what levels. So we need to start developing what kind of level could be safe. Now, for me, I don't know that there's any safe level of a compound that never goes away and enters your body and stays there forever. I mean, there's no question that that's going to cause problems for people forever. But we do need to start developing a process to regulate these chemicals.
You're listening to the Coastline Candidate Interviews. Today, our focus is North Carolina's House District 20, covering part of northern New Hanover County. Challenger Adam Erickson is with me now. You say that you converted to Catholicism in 2014 and that your religion has become an important guide in your life. How would that affect your policy making?
Well, I think the primary influence on me is the idea of service, social justice. Those things are very important to me and my family, and it really informs what I do every day when I get up and how I face the world and how I deal with people. The idea that we find meaning in our life through service to others is paramount to me. I mean, there's nothing physical that I can own that can surpass the idea of helping others. And that is maybe part of the reason why I do what I do as a teacher. It's just it's something that drives me, and it'll drive the way I look at my service in the state legislature.
Your opponent is very proud of his work, signing on to four abortion-related bills, including House Bill 602, which is called the Born Alive Abortion Survivors Protection Act, preventing the killing of a child born after an unsuccessful abortion. And he talks about the veto override of this bill failing and how he watched the Liberal Democrats celebrate after the vote and how awful it made him feel. I asked him if he genuinely believed that Democrats are eager to murder babies. Is it accurate, first of all, that you as a Democrat would celebrate the freedom to murder newborn babies? How would you respond to
Man,
that notion?
I just think that extremist talk like that does nothing to work on the actual issues that face real people. That's creating scenarios and putting people on the spot for that kind of extremist talk divides people. The fact is that I support a woman's right to choose. That's the law of our land. And the vast majority of people across this country, across this state, do the same.
Does
And
that not conflict with your faith?
well, I mean, everybody comes, I think faith is a private matter. It's not a government matter. It's not something for me to impose on other people. The freedom to practice religion as you wish is a closely held tenet of our value in our society. And I firmly believe that your religious views are your private views, and your service as a legislator requires you to follow the law and to serve all people across your community.
You say that state legislators need to make sure that our farmers stay strong and resilient and also leverage 21st century technology to protect neighboring communities from some of those farming activities. And you say downstream communities from the dangerous byproducts of large farming operations. You're talking about concentrated animal feeding operations here, CAFOs. What does need to happen? What needs to change in those operations?
Well, I think we need to make sure that we protect and promote business, agricultural business, but we also have a responsibility to protect our neighbors and the environment that belongs to all of us. And we don't need to sacrifice one to have the other. We don't just have to sacrifice environmental protections in order to have business. It won't work in the long term, I think we can work together. I think we can have adequate protections that don't damage the agricultural owner, business person, worker, and at the same time protect people who have nothing to do with that operation.
But what needs to change? I mean, there are a number of different elements. Some of that, the effluent from those CAFOs does get into nearby waterways and move downstream, and other people complain about the spraying that goes on of this effluent contaminating the air. So how would you change that? Because what you're talking about is having farmers fundamentally change the way they operate.
Well, I mean, impacting your neighbors and damaging our environment is not really an acceptable business practice. You know, that can't be an excuse to, not have environmentally sound practices. So, leakage from hog farms and spraying of the effluent on neighbors that gets into neighboring lands, that can't be allowed to happen. Oftentimes it's the least well off who end up suffering the consequences of those actions. And we just have to make sure that businesses in that sector are operating with sound environmental practices and make sure that their pollution is not impacting the rest of us.
Have you learned anything in the last, say, 10 months about systemic racism or white privilege that you didn't know before, particularly as a white man? And do you think there's a need for any kind of racial reconciliation in North Carolina?
Well, I think that as a teacher in a high poverty school, a Title I school, it's certainly something that is in front of me all the time, inequities in our system. You know, there's a lot of more awareness today than ever of the bias in our system that exists, no matter who you are or where you come from. I come from a very lower socioeconomic working class family. And I thought that would connect me automatically to a lot of the kids that I serve. But despite the fact that I grew up with a single mom who cleaned houses and waited tables, my ability to do well in high school, have a great school, go to college with scholarships, go to graduate school, potentially serve in the state house of a legislature. It's just amazing. And I have opportunities that some of the kids I work with just do not have. And a lot of that has to do with the racial aspect of it. It's different all over the country, of course. You know, the legacy of communities are different everywhere you come from. But I know that I have a leg up just the way, because of the way I look. You know, I will have advantages that the kids I work with never have. And that makes me aware that, you know, there are things we can do perhaps to level the playing field, you know, to understand the system that we live in and how it unfairly impacts people.
Was there any particular revelation or understanding that was new for you this year?
This year in relation to...
Yeah, given to this conversation about racial reconciliation.
For this year. Well, you know, the events of this year did not just begin this year. You know, this has been a long process. This has been a long time coming. The George Floyd murder was just the latest in a long string of events that have been going on for years. Maybe even decades, because many times these things weren't reported. So I think that it's sometimes easy for us to be complacent in our lives and say, I'm doing my little bit to help and I've got my piece of everything and let everybody else figure it out for themselves. But when there's a systemic issue that we are confronted with, criminal justice, social justice, and we just continue to look the other way, you know, we're failing ourselves and we're failing our society. if we don't do anything about it, especially if it's the cause of systemic issues and not just, you know, some people behaving badly.
Do you think Confederate monuments should be on public grounds?
Well, I'm a history teacher. I've been studying and reading about the Civil War and our history since I was a kid. I do not feel that monuments to white supremacy and a racist system should be on public grounds. You know, I think there are places for those things, museums, other areas. But, you know, in the public place where we all have to come together and live as one, I don't think that a monument to that racist past can be celebrated in a public square.
Coronavirus is, of course, political. There are critics of Governor Cooper's executive orders signed to stop the spread of COVID-19. Some have said it's hysteria. Some say it's a national democratic issue designed to slow the economy and discredit the president. North Carolina is even seeing a troubling trend upwards now, even after all of the measures taken. What would you do if you could shape policy on coronavirus in the state?
Well, of course, as a legislator, I wouldn't be dictating any kind of policy, and you know, I would be working with a lot of different people, including health experts, who would be able to offer guidance, and we can make decisions as a group. So I don't think there's one thing I'm going to do per se, other than, you know, look at the situation, the data that we're given, the evidence that we're given, and make the best decisions for this state. It's pretty clear that the way things are going now, we're just dragging our feet along and not really making the best decisions to really get rid of this virus, attack it head on, support our people, our businesses while this is going on, and then come out of it together.
By supporting businesses, are you saying financial support from the government, or are you saying allow them to be open?
Oh, I think that we need to have more support, grants, small business loans, things like that. I think as soon as people start getting together, the virus spreads. We're already seeing it in our schools as people come back together, and it's inevitable. Nobody wants businesses to be closed. We love restaurants. We love, entertainment. We've missed it greatly. We have friends who are struggling mightily and in those businesses, and we'd love to have them back open. But if they're open, full out open, we're going to have a lot more sickness and death. And the number one job of government is public safety, and we have to protect that.
And is there any role that state legislators play in addressing climate change in North Carolina?
Oh, absolutely. Especially in a coastal community, we're going to have to start thinking about long-term infrastructure, especially along the coastline. We have a lot of coastal communities, and the sea levels are rising. There's no doubt about that. We're having a lot more storms, a lot worse storms. We have a lot more damage to deal with, infrastructure issues. There's a whole host of things. We may have to deal with changes in agricultural policies. So there's a whole host of things that we'll need to address in terms of climate change.
And that is this edition of Coastline. Adam Erickson, Democratic challenger for North Carolina House District 20. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thank you. It's a great pleasure being here. And thank you for what your program does for this community. It's a great service.
Thank you. Thanks also to Republican Representative Ted Davis Jr. One-stop voting is underway and runs through October 31st. North Carolina voters can request absentee ballots until October 27th. Election day is November 3rd. Coastline's producer is Rachel Keith. Technical director is Ken Campbell. Andrew Craig engineered today's show. Coastline is a production of WHQR Public Media. I'm Rachel Lewis Hilburn for Coastline.